equation you know. And the way he described it sounded like a poem. So I was like, wow, there's not a lot of difference between what he's doing and what I'm trying to do. You know, like our worlds, we live in the same world, kind of. You know, I always thought it was different. It's not.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is a great, I'm so glad I got to have you in the studio.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for this great opportunity. This is so exciting. Like, this is like huge microphone in front of me. This is all so like incredible. I've never done anything like this. I'm so excited. I'm like a newbie trying to touch everything. Yeah.
You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Pamela Santos with Nancy Huang, and her book you can get from Right Bloody Publishing is titled Favorite Daughter. The music in our program, I See You, was provided by Portland producer Nathaniel Zablon at nathanieljams.com. Have a good one. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st, through Saturday, March 2nd. The Cascade Festival of African Films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include Razzia, a film from Morocco, and more at the Hollywood Theater, and Wale from Burkina Faso, Fig Tree from Ethiopia, shorts from emerging African filmmakers, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104, at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Nice job. Those numbers are pretty sweet.
Are they? You know, I hadn't even noticed. And how is Georgie doing?
He's doing great. I love working with that big guy.
Keep the doors coming, Charlie. I'm on a roll today.
George and I are like brothers. 2319! We have a 2319!
Red alert.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser, and I am honored to be here in the studio with one of the great voice actors of all time. You'll recognize some of his characters from Disney and Pixar movies, from Nickelodeon series, and from video games. He's been a member of the Firesign Theater for decades, and he's the author, along with Brad Schreiber, of the memoir, Where's My Fortune Cookie? Phil Proctor, it's a pleasure to have you here in the studio.
It's nice to be here. S.W., can I call you Conk?
You can call me Conch, if you like, or Conk.
Conk? Just, yeah. They say Conk in Key West.
They do. It's the Conk Republic there.
Yeah, it's the Conk Republic. But anyway, it's nice to be here at a familiar station, KBOO. Firesign Theater used to come down here after every show whenever we were in the Portland area and hang out and get on the radio and have some fun.
We'd let you drive the station. We'd just put you in the air room and we'd leave town.
Now I'm being driven into the station, and that's a lot easier, actually. But yes, it's an interesting intro that you made. I wrote my memoir, Where's My Fortune Cookie, collaborating with Brad Schreiber, who's a teacher of a comedy, a writer about comedy. Also, he's written a couple of serious books. He wrote one about Jimi Hendrix. Very interesting guy. And I've known him as a friend for years. And one morning, he said to me about 3 years ago, you know, you really got to write your autobiography or something like it before you can't remember anything anymore. And I said, do I know you? And he said, I'll help you with it. I said, good, because I have tried to write my autobiography over the decades, first on a typewriter, then on a computer, and then on my phone. And I've never been able to do it because I'm still too busy. After being in the business for over 65 years, because I started at 9 years old doing a live television show in New York called called Uncle Danny Reads the Funnies. I'm still busy enough at my age that it's difficult to sit down. So I said, okay, you come in. He brought in a tape recorder, and I told my stories, and then he did a first draft, and then we edited the first draft together, and the book is out now on Amazon.com. It's been out for over a year. Everybody seems to love it, which is very satisfying. I also created a podcast with some other producer friends of mine. I went to a studio in Brooklyn, and we laid down a reading of the book, and that's now on podbean.com. Every Friday, you'll hear a new episode of it. Not necessarily a chapter, because we wanted to do thematic selections. And it's going to be cut together and released as a book on tape in December. Okay? Now, Where's My Fortune Cookie is so named because when Peter Bergman and I were touring the country in the 70s, we ended up in San Francisco at a Chinese restaurant late at night, 2:30 in the morning, and suddenly three guys came in with shotgun, a pistol, and machine gun and shot up the place. And it was called the Golden Dragon Massacre. That was the name of the restaurant, the Golden Dragon. And Peter.
And when was this?
This was in 1977.
Okay.
And Peter and I survived.
What I remember from your story at Pete Bergman's memorial up in the Seattle area was that Pete actually was instrumental in getting these guys caught because his experience in the Korean War.
Well, Peter never really fought in the Korean War. He was in the army.
But he knew the sound of an automatic weapon running out of bullets.
That's exactly right.
So he poked his head up from under the table where you guys were ducking.
And you saw just these guys leaving, right?
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, they were wearing nylon stockings over their faces, but nonetheless, you could get a physical description of them and everything. 5 killed, 11 wounded. And at the time, it was the worst massacre in American history. Imagine that. 5 dead. Anyway, I hid under the steel column of the table. And that morning I'd learned that my wife was pregnant. So I was mad. I wasn't scared at all. I was like, you know, why are these guys doing this to innocent people? And I may never get to see my child. This is not right. And finally, when it all ended and everything, Peter and I were okay. There's more to this story. Of course, it's all in the book. But the reason why it's called Where's My Fortune Cookie is an old girlfriend of mine who lived with me with Jeremy Clyde of Chad and Jeremy in a big house in Encino when we were Columbia recording artists together back in the late 60s. This old girlfriend of mine connected up with me in New York in a very strange psychic way. I spent an evening with her up in Ossining, New York, where Puharich was studying psychic events and Uri Geller, who later turned out to be a fraud in many ways, but was still an interesting guy. Spent an evening together, and at one point in the evening she said, you know, Philip, I hate to tell people bad news, but she said, I have to tell you, you're going to be involved in a shooting between foreigners, and people will be killed and wounded around you, but you and Peter will be okay. And she says, it'll be after a show. I can't tell you when. I don't know when. 2 months later, it happened. Now, why is the book called Where's My Fortune Cookie? When Peter's memorial was down in the Electric Lodge in Venice, because we did one up north.
Oh, you did one up in Kirkland,
One in Kirkland, and then we did one down in Venice, in Los Angeles. This wonderful lady, Gretchen Steiner, she was kind of a booster, and she'd come and help us with our merchandise and everything, just voluntarily. Wonderful person. Well, she made fortune cookies for this event. And they had Peter Bergman's name, his date of birth, his date of death, and the title of one of our albums. And she gave these out to everybody. After the event was over, I said, Gretchen, that is so nice of you to do that because, you know, it reminds everybody of the Golden Dragon Massacre. And she said, what? I said, the Chinese gangland shooting that Peter and I were involved in? She says, what are you talking about? I said, now, wait a minute, Gretchen. You made all these fortune cookies, Chinese fortune cookies, and you don't know that Peter and I survived a gangland shooting? She said, no. I said, well, why did you do it? And she said, because Peter came to me in a dream and said, I never got my fortune cookie.
That's vintage Bergman.
You know, Peter shows up regularly in my dreams, right, as does my late partner, Phil Austin, who passed away about 2 years ago. This is, for those who don't know, Fireside Theater is a four-man satirical comedy group.
Four or five crazy guys.
Yeah, we call ourselves the four or five crazy guys, because the fifth crazy guy is the result of our collaboration. Whatever comes out, the writing that we finally finish up with that goes on the record or goes on the stage or wherever, you know, television or a new film. And that's the amalgamation of all of our comic sensibilities and our suggestions in the final draft of the thing, which is then augmented usually by improvisation before we actually record or when we record it and all that. So history. I've lived long enough now, and I hope I continue to live longer, that I have this bizarre, huge history. So after the Firesign Theater had attained a certain degree of success, and we were now touring the country and playing Carnegie Hall and the Beacon Theater in New York and Portland many times, we did various other things.
And you also, you're really close with Pete Bergman, who was considered the showrunner for the Firesign Theater, and you did Procter and Bergman albums.
Bergman came out of the fact that there was a schism in the group. Dave and Phil wanted to, after we toured for a while, they said, okay, enough of that. Let's just stay in L.A. and make albums. And Peter and I said, no. We got to go out. We got to meet our fans. We got to get inspired by our fans. We got to know what's happening out in the world, because we were energized by it. And so they said, okay, well, do what you will, and we're going to, you know, stay here. So Peter and I formed Procter & Bergman. We got a contract to do our first record, TV or Not TV, which predicted cable television, basically. And we started touring behind it and doing cabaret. And it was very successful. We had, you know, a seven-year touring career, but we'd come back and work with the Firesign on some of the albums. Dave and Phil wrote an album called In the Next World You're on Your Own. Good album. That particular album came after Everything You Know Is Wrong. Everything You Know Is Wrong and The Martian Space Party and a few of our other short films have been released on a two DVD set called Everything You Know Is Wrong, the declassified Fireside Theater. Again, available at our website, firesidetheater.com, along with a lot of books that we put together, compilations of our scripts, a Shakespearean parody called Anything You Want To in book form, which is a parody of academic footnotes, because it's all these footnotes are responding to the words. I mean, we've done so many different kinds of parodies, but you can get, if you go to the website, you can take a look and see what you want. Bear Manor Press has put out a lot of our stuff as well.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and we are talking today with actor, author, cartoon voice, and Firesign Theater co-originator, Phil Procter. And we are delighted to have Phil Procter in the studio here today.
Let me out!
Hi, Howard. Hi, Betty. How are you?
Well.
Well, Deed. We are totally psyched for this birthday thing, aren't we, Howard?
Well, Betty.
Oh, don't mind Howard, Deedee. He's just a little frazzed on account of all these kids.
Actually.
I mean, the twins are enough of an armload, and today we got little Chuckster. Hey, you think we could just pen these books?
Well, shifting gears here, speaking personally as somebody in the animation industry, I've always found radio theater people to be great at providing voices for animated films and cartoons. And this is something that you leapt into with both feet, and you have worked on...
With my tongue, anyway.
With your tongue. You've worked on multiple Disney and Pixar films, series for Nickelodeon, video games. I'm interested in how this started for you and how you like to work, because I know that some studios, they'll get the actors in individual time slots.
Yes,
you'll come
right.
in, you'll have
that's
your right. half hour, the other person will have
it's more efficient,
the other half hour. But there are other directors, other animators, who love to have everybody in the same studio, behind multiple mics, interacting like their characters would.
Yeah.
And in fact, famously, Wes Anderson, when he was creating the Fantastic Mr. Fox with Mark Gustafson, he took all of the actors out into the English countryside and recorded them all outside as their characters might be.
Oh, that's I didn't know that story. I got into professional voiceover work because I had done so many voices with the Fireside Theater. We had reached a certain point of fame, and I was pretty much in Los Angeles at this point. So the way to get into it was to get an agent. So with our wonderful producer, Fred Jones, with whom we did many, many albums, Fred put together a voice reel for me, my first voice reel.
With Rocky Rococo from Nick Danger, Third Eye.
Well, I did some of the Firesign parody stuff, but remember, I was playing to a different audience now. This was a commercial reel, because I wanted to get radio spots and industrials and things like that. So it had to be straight, you know, as straight as I could be. But I was parroting what I heard to create, you know, the verisimilitude that I was a straight guy doing, you know, straight commercials, whereas I was a twisted funny guy doing straight commercials. And that worked, because once I got my tongue in the door and it was actually represented and was able to read for all this stuff, I began to get jobs because I could handle fast dialogue, I could handle tricky words, and I did a lot of industrial work. And this also led to on-camera work as well in commercials. So I had a nice run in the days when there were three networks, and if you got a national commercial, you could buy a car. You know, it really was a lucrative business. And that helped to kind of underwrite my work with the Firesign Theater, okay, obviously. But it wasn't until later that I actually got into film and television using my voice. And that was through some friends of mine, like Lee French, who had created what are known as loop groups. Most people don't realize that in every television show and every movie, all the background players are only pretending to talk. And after the film is cut together, a group of talented, crazy people, usually 10 to 12, girls and guys, come into a studio and add the voices in the background for all the restaurant scenes and all of the shootouts and all the football games and you name it. And then I was introduced to a group run by a lady named Mickey McGowan, exclusively focused on doing animation features. And the first animation feature that I was invited to join the group with was the Something Down Under. What's it called?
The Rescuers Down Under.
Yes, the Rescuers Down Under. Yeah, Australian. And we did different accents and things for that. And then it was followed by Beauty and the Beast.
Ah, yes.
Which was, you know, mind-boggling,
it's a monster hit.
Revelation. But for us, going in and adding voices to these characters and hearing that music, you know, we said, oh, this should be a Broadway musical. Well, of course.
That was the late Howard Ashman,
yes.
Who was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, yes. I mean, and we all felt really gifted, honored to be a part of this growing CGI animation format. Because the ballroom scene was done in computer animation. Okay, like a first experiment at it. And then we became connected to Pixar and John Lasseter and their body of work. And I was with them through Finding Nemo and Monsters Incorporated and Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2 and The Bug's Life and on through all of these wonderful things. It was actually The Bug's Life, which my Firesign partner David Osman, he played a major role. He played opposite Phyllis Diller, who was the Ant Queen, and he was her right hand or his six-legged man or whatever. And at the cast and crew party up in San Francisco, in City Hall, for A Bug's Life, I met Steve Jobs, who had bought stock in the company because he wanted to help them develop their software, okay? And he said, I'm a big fan of yours, when I met him. And I said, oh, that's great. You know, I'm a big fan of yours, too. And, you know, and it was when we were collecting material for our archives to send to Washington, D.C., when they acquired our archives for $500,000, that we came across a bunch of pictures. I think they were actually proof sheets of a record signing that we did up in Berkeley. when Firesign was performing up there in the early years, in the probably the early 70s. And one of the people hanging out with us was this bearded, long-haired guy. And we looked at him and we said, "That's Steve Jobs." And he was a big fan of ours. He knew us from the beginning. And it was the record, I think we're all bozos on this bus, which predicted the computer revolution that really turned him on to us. So much so that, now I'm going to talk to
you
Siri.
You broke the president.
That's right, we did. But here, I'm going to talk to Siri. This is Worker speaking. Hello.
Hello, Aklem. What function can I perform for you? LOL.
All right. Firesign people who know, I think we're all bozos on this bus, know that the part I played, Clem, because the computer said, "What's your name?" And I went, "Clem." "Hello, Clem," you know. Clem was a disaffected worker who'd been fired from this thing called the Future Fair, which was a computer-generated illusion, okay? And he, to revenge himself, goes in to the mainframe computer, Dr. Memory, Direct Readout Memory, and he plants a virus. He was a hacker, and he planted a virus, and the virus was a Zen koan, why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air, which the Dr. Memory could not answer in a yes or no, yes or no, yes or no, the whole binary thing that makes up computers. And to get access to this, I would say, "This is Worker speaking, hello," and then he would say, "Hello, worker, what can I do for you?" And that was how I got in to plant the virus. Well, Steve Jobs put this into Siri in his iPhone as an homage to the Firesign Theater.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
It's amazing.
So again, we've had this enormous and subtle, almost subliminal cultural effect on the country. And yet if you watch a show like The History of Comedy, you know, there's no mention of the Firesign Theater. It's just as though we never existed, which is kind of what we set out to do, in a way. We set out to be subterfuge, to create subterfuge or sabotage, in a way.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Kanzer, and we're talking today with actor, author, cartoon voice, and Firesign Theater co-originator Phil Proctor. His memoir is called Where's My Fortune Cookie?
Those teenagers, Doc, they can drive a man to drink.
Hey, what are you drinking?
Gatorade.
Oh, really? Give it to me. Gatorade make wine now, huh?
Blah.
You better slow down.
I have a favorite new story about you in the animation industry.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of Animaniac fans out there among our mm-hmm. listeners, and they will certainly enjoy the characters Pinky and the Brain. And I understand that you had a major influence on creation
yeah,
of
right.
Pinky and the Brain.
That's right. I was doing Tasmania. As I started to say, when I got into commercial radio spots for all different kinds of products, it led to the ADR, and then it led to the animation stuff.
Automatic dialogue replacement. Yeah.
Automatic dialogue replacement, or additional dumb replies, or something. Well, I did several cartoons. I worked first with Hanna-Barbera on the Smurfs. On the Smurfs, I was a character named King Gerard. And I had a little Clockwork Smurf played by another very talented voiceover artist, Frank Welker, who could, you know, do mechanical sounds. He could do anything. And then that led to being cast in Tasmania, Saturday morning cartoon. And Jim Cummings played Taz.
The Tasmanian Devil.
Yeah, and I played the leader of the Bushrats.
Another Australian part.
Yeah, and another Australian part, Mr. Wallaby, okay? And among the cast was Maurice LaMarche, who has been a friend for decades and decades. And Maurice LaMarche had a wonderful, deep kind of Orson Welles' voice. So I brought in a tape of Orson Welles infamous performance on a commercial he was supposed to do for a Norwegian fast food company called Findus Frozen Foods. Mrs. Wells, you know, plants peas in this field. It's ridiculous. You can't see the field. You should have snow covered.
He was critiquing the way the commercial was written and directed the entire time.
Right. They'd hired him to do the narration of the commercial, and he was rebelling against it every step of the way, and they were pestering him. And it was, I think it was Canadian ad people who were trying to do this thing. And finally, at the end, he walks out on the session. Well, I played this famous, infamous Orson Welles tape. You can probably just Google it. I have. You know, it's called Findus Frozen Foods or Orson Welles and Frozen Food Commercial, anything like that. You'll find it. And I played it for Maurice LaMarche.
This is before the internet really got rolling.
Oh, internet or what?
Yeah, this was back in the 90s.
Internet. Yeah. No, this was at least two decades before that revolution when we were doing this, or at least one decade. And certainly it wasn't popularized and nobody had it. So I played a cassette tape for him. And he loved it so much, he gave him the tape, he memorized it, and he began to do Orson Welles in our recording sessions. Whenever there was something that he didn't agree with or he just wanted to have fun with the director, he'd say, "No actor in Shakespeare can do this." He'd do his Welles character. And that inspired them to do Pinky and the Brain. That was the inspiration for it. And in one of the episodes, you'll actually hear a kind of a recreation of that recording session where Maurice's character, the Brain, is definitely playing Orson Welles.
Yes, it's a fake educational film about what goes on in a radio studio.
Yes, something like that. That's right. So anyway, working with people like Maurice and Frank Welker. And you mentioned earlier something about the different techniques that directors like to use to record things. Now, I'm Howard on the Rugrats.
Howard DeVille.
Yeah,
no
Howard
relation
DeVille.
To Cruella.
That's right. Howard DeVille. Howard in the Rugrats, which is coming back next year for 26 new episodes and a CGI movie, which is wonderful. But in any event, doing voices like that are generally isolated, but sometimes they'll bring in two characters if the interaction is really important, or three characters if the interaction is really important in a little studio booth. And it depends on the choice of the director. He has that option open to him. Also, most of the time you have to imagine what the other character is going to talk like or look like. For the most part, because we're a repertory company, in our cartoon, Rugrats, it was pretty easy to do that. But when I first started out doing the Smurfs, it was a room full of actors over at the Hanna-Barbera Studios. And I'd be sitting next to Jonathan Winters. Yeah, and
wow.
Alan Young, and various other stars that I admired performing with them. And that was very, very thrilling. So it's up to the discretion of the director and the producer as to... The Tick worked that way.
I love the Tick.
And the whole Firesign Theater appeared on The Tick, because it turns out that one of the producers or the directors or everybody was a big fan of Firesign Theater, right? So they said, "Do you think we could get the other guys?" I said, "Well, I'll ask, you know." And I called, "Hey, they want us to do The Tick. They want us to do The Tick. They want us to do The Tick. Oh, yeah, sure, let's do The Tick." And I said, "Yeah, I think I can get the other guys to do it." And so we went in and we did, I think, two episodes, Coach Somebody's Lament or whatever. I played one famous character on The Tick, and they actually made an in-action figure of my character, The Chair. The evil villain, The Chair. Yes, that was one of my better-known characters. But anyway, to answer your question, the majority of people, especially Pixar, Disney, and the lot, you come in alone, and you work however many hours or days are required to get that character down. And then they'll put it together, and they'll, you know, start to edit the film, and they'll start to put in the special effects. They might call you back to revoice something or to add more lines. And I'm also the drunken French monkey in the Dr. Dolittle movies. I am a social drinker. And in that instance, working with Betty Thomas, we could improvise because we weren't syncing to the monkey. They were going to make the monkey's mouth and everything work with computer generation to whatever our lines were. Okay? In general, when you do a cartoon, they put together what they call a radio play. We do our lines, they cut it all together with overlaps and whatever is necessary, and then they play that, and that's the basis for the animation when they send it off to Korea or wherever the hell they're going to do it, Brooklyn.
Well, Phil Proctor, it's been a pleasure to have you back in the studio again. And gosh, there's so much more to talk about. I'd love to get into some of your film work over the years. You've worked with Henry Jaglom. You've worked with various directors.
And Orson Welles.
Orson Welles.
A Safe Place, first movie I did.
You dated Karen Black. You've done films with the Firesign Theater, including one up on Mount Hood.
That's right.
Yeah.
The comedy Monks.
Right. Yeah. How can people find out more about your work?
Okay.
And your book, your book along with Brad Schreiber, Where's My Fortune Cookie?
Where's My Fortune Cookie? You can go to planetproctor.com and you can sign up for my profusely illustrated newsletter, which I send out free every month or so, called Planet Proctor. So go to planetproctor.com. You'll see an archive of the last 20 years of Planet Proctor. And if you like it and you want to get a free subscription, just let me know. My email is phil.proctor@mac.com, but there you can also connect up through the website.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and our guest today has been Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater. Phil, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fun supplying the words. Now you have to supply the pictures.
I do, and people can find out more by going online at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Music Film Festival through February 16th at the Whitfield Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. On Thursday, January 31st, the Real Music Festival will screen the documentary Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band. This film investigates the history